Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good to be back. It's been a while. Yeah. Been asked to talk about chapter 7, Evil's Lie, in Father Rohr's book. It's a topic that many of us Christians seem to shy away from. But as Pope John Paul II said, it's important that we not be naive about evil. We have to learn when and where and how to denounce before we can announce. How to denounce what is wrong or bad or evil, what is not of God, and then to announce the good news, what is good and holy and right and just. And so I begin just by kind of giving you a collage of things to help us to understand some premises. Is that if you could think of it almost like two parallel premises or kingdoms. That which serves the kingdom of God is very different than that which serves the kingdom of the evil one. All right? So, for example, God is about truth. There was an old poster many years ago in the 70s that said, "The truth will set you free, the first will make you miserable." There's a lot of truth to that, in the sense that we all know that it's hard for us to be authentic or to speak the truth because we want to come across as being better than we really are. Would you agree?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. But the kingdom of darkness is not about truth at all. It's about cover-up. It's about pretending. It's about putting on masks. It's about, I want you to see the best in me and not who I really am. Okay? So this is why darkness, evil, always, always depends on disguises. Disguises. Not about authenticity at all. On the contrary, it's about a false premise. A false perspective. In depth psychology, the term that we use is persona, which comes from a word that means mask. Also, it's where we get the word mascara. Okay, it's the idea that I only want you to see what I want you to perceive of me. Okay, so it's a filtering out. It's a filtering out. So, at some level, if we can say the kingdom of God is about truth. The kingdom of darkness is about lies and deceits. This is why evil, at its essence, is about control. Because I want to control my reality. I want to be able to make it work the way I want it to work. But as we see by the life and the words and the modeling of Jesus, that he's always about freedom. Remember that great discussion that he had with many of the religious elite when he spoke about this, the Gospel of John. They said, "We've never been slaves to anyone." And Jesus can see they don't understand what he's talking about. He's talking about an inner freedom, a right relationship, not only with God, but a right relationship with everyone and everything. One of the tools that we can often use of controlling our reality, again from the field of death psychology, is called projection. Projection. If you remember the old projectors that used to project films, the way it worked is that you had the film inside the mechanism and it threw or projected the image onto the screen. Okay, so it's a bit of language that's used by C.G. Jung as we describe what we often do in terms of our inner life. That the things that we cannot accept about ourselves, the parts of us that we do not like, that perhaps we even hate or despise, or we never tell anybody, we put on somebody else. This is why we love to watch movies, or we love to read novels, or we poke fun at political candidates, and religious authorities, and people in authority, because they carry for us, again another term from depth psychology, they carry for us the scapegoat. Right? They carry for us the part of us that we don't want to own as our own. Bless you. And it's indeed a challenge. The sign of maturity as a human being is that you're able to own both. Because that mechanism of projection is something fascinating. We don't just project out our badness or our darkness or our evil. We also project out our good. This is why we worship heroes and heroines. Okay? So we have scapegoats, but we also have scapegoats. Look what's happened to Backlash, for example, of Tiger Woods. You know? Is that we often have that saying that gone from hero to goat really quick. Because both are out of balance. Both are out of balance. to recognize that you have both. You are both a goat and you're a hero. You have good qualities, you have bad qualities. We all do. That's what it means to be human, what it means to be a creature. But to hold them in that paradoxical relationship, putting in theology now, means that you can stand and recognize that you are both sinner and saint. Sinner and saint. In this equal balance of reality. And the parson, for whatever reason that you cannot or will not accept about yourself, you will put in the lap of somebody else. This is why sometimes there's such excessive devotionalism around certain saints. Okay? Or we can even use that language around certain sports heroes and heroines. Or certain political or religious individuals. Because they carry for us a part of us that we cannot own. Let me give you an example. I remember when I was, I must have been about 15 at the time. I was taking art classes. And my Aunt Kathy had come to visit, and she'd asked how my classes were coming along. At that time, I was using the media of oil. And she really enjoyed what I was painting. And she went ooey and aahing for quite a while. Just embarrassed me. I said, Aunt Kathy, I said, you know, it's nothing. I said, if you could do it, she said, oh, I could never do that. And I said, you know, I think you can. I'll tell you why. Because you're one of the few people that have really noticed particular aspects of my painting. She couldn't accept it. But it was interesting. About 5 years later, she started taking classes herself. She's much better than I am. This is how God helps us to grow, you see, is that God puts it out there and says, you know, it doesn't feel like it right now, but the very fact that you're so attracted about this person's talent means you've got it. But it's in seed form. Theirs is just more developed. This is one reason why we very often will kill prophets or people that are two steps ahead of us. If they're one step ahead of us, we worship them, we admire them, we lift them up. We sing their praises. Two steps, we want to kill them. Because we think that somehow or another they're demonic. Because they're so beyond my value system. They're saying or doing things that I cannot accept, and so they must be of the evil one. Just the other night, I heard a woman say, I'm not kidding you, she said, for example, that Eckhart Tolle is the devil. Not of the devil, is. You're kidding. This was her parameter. He was too far ahead of her. So she just dismissed the whole thing. He's the devil. So it's a sign of real immaturity. And we all do it. In one way, shape, or another. According to the context of our life. Here's the other thing. Is that that which is dark or evil or we're unable to receive about ourselves, we put out there as well. And why in those movies or those stories, we can feel so good for just a while when somebody's put to death. I know it for myself, true confession here. There's a lot of tension going inside of me. I purposely choose TV programs or movies to sit and watch, and I know exactly what I'm doing. I'm putting all that frustration energy into that figure. You know? And can root and cheer on us. Yeah, give it to him. He deserves it. But that's the key, is to be conscious, to be aware of what you're really doing. I know it's not about him, it's about me. It's about me. Now let's face it, I'm not going to ask you a show of hands, but this is why children are given you as gifts. Your kids bring out the very worst in you, wouldn't you agree? Wouldn't you agree? And the very best. Don't you know yourself differently because of especially your teenage children? That's what we're talking about. This is real stuff. Real stuff. So, we are both. We are both sinners and saints. So the scapegoat mechanism is both a personal and a cultural way of helping us to divest ourselves of our own, shall we say, darkness or unclaimed evil. And I'm sure you all remember this story, but this was a common occurrence, and usually it was done annually amongst the Hebrew people, is they literally would take a goat, bring a goat into the midst of the community, and through the priest, they would lay hands on the goat. And they would, in their own imagination, give to the goat all of the stuff that they no longer wanted. We would call it sin. Okay? So their hubris, their sexual sins, their deceitfulness, the way they'd hurt each other, neighbors, and what, all of it. It's like, put it on the goat. And then they'd all sit back, and they would take stones and sticks and start throwing at the goat. Some of them would go up and kick the goat to go out in the desert. And it was meant to be a symbol of being washed clean, that, you know, we no longer own this stuff. It's now been given to the goat. Okay? We do this societally in so many different ways. If we come across somebody, for example, who embodies for us something we don't approve of, we do this either through our voice, our words, our attitudes. Remember the story, I can't remember his name, the young gay man in Wyoming?
Matthew,
that's right. Perfect example. Now, what's going on there? Now, this may surprise you. This stuff is real. This stuff is rated mature audience, if you listen to this tape. All right? Is that these young men couldn't accept the fact of their own inner gayness. You see, I'm going to say this in a very clear way, and at time of question, you can question me on this. But we are all heterosexual and homosexual. For some of us, it is conscious, and for some, it's unconscious. What does that mean, psychologically? It means that if you do not have an element of homosexuality, you could not relate to members of your own gender. Heterosexuality means that you have the capacity also to relate to members of the other gender. Okay? So you have both. And to recognize, this is why people get so frustrated when they have dreams like, oh, I wouldn't tell this to anybody, but it was a homoerotic dream and not heterosexual. Well, that's good that you're paying attention. The dream world has a completely different morality than what you impose on it. It's about waking you up to wholeness. To wholeness. In who God is. It's about waking up in the fullness of who you are as a beloved daughter or son of God. And that's why it takes such work, such patience, such maturity, and such humility. And why you do need a guide. Anyone who's serious about the spiritual life cannot do it alone. Is that each one of us need wise women and men to guide us along this journey of this work of unification, this work of wholeness. So one of the temptations in this whole movement of coming to wholeness is to slip into either-or thinking. And that is that this is bad and this is good. You know, that works very well for children and for immature adults. But you actually, when you get, you know, into midlife, at least by midlife, you begin to realize that that's not as true as you think. Because most of life is gray. It's a combination of both. The combination of both. Not so much black or white. It's a lot of grayness. A lot of things that are not clear. That you can't underline and say, okay, check that off. This is bad. And this is good. Okay? So how would one discern evil? And these are just some guidelines. Think of these as like bullet points to help you discern what's really going on here. One of the things I can share with you from my experience is that pure, unadulterated evil, you usually sense interiorly by a coldness. We often say the warmth of the Holy Spirit. Well, with pure evil, it's cold. Okay? We're not talking about temperature, it's a sense of coldness. Alright? Jesus had all human emotions like we do. And so there's a lot of, if you will, humor. And to be able to laugh at oneself is a sign of maturity. So to weep and to laugh in tandem is the soul seeing both the truth and the absurdity of life. So if you have a good sense of humor, you truly are walking in your sonship or daughterhood in Christ. You see? But if you take yourself too seriously and there's no place for laughter, you want to ask yourself, you're holding on pretty tight, you need to control your image. Being too serious. Or too, oh my God, we don't laugh at that stuff. I remember growing up in my family, oh, for God's sake, you never talk about sex. You know, sexual feelings. That, it was kind of funny because, you know, there's 11 kids in our family. So it's like, we never talked about it. We never joked about it. But it was kind of funny. Once my parents got to a certain age, I don't know what happened to them. It's all they wanted to talk about. And they were joking about it. Mom was talking about how it was so different making love with a man who couldn't keep a strong erection. It's like, Mom, please don't worry. So sometimes that's what happens, is you flip from one side to the other. It's like, we don't go there, to, doesn't matter. No? Truth is found somewhere in the middle. And this is why, again, children are such a gift to parents and grandparents, because they bring up everything. And if you find yourself getting a little bit embarrassed, usually it's a sign, it's a little trigger. It's a little trigger for you that, oh, I'm much more worried what people think of me or perceive me to be than the truth of who I am. You got it? Okay, so here are some ways to discern, is this of God or not? First off, evil is characterized by a sense of certainty or clarity. Be wary of people who say, I know this to be true, you know, and they just keep beating it down again and again and again. Now, this is not the same as somebody saying, for me this is true because of my life experience. But when you try and go from a personal to a universal, be very careful. That's not of God. It's rare that Jesus makes universal statements. You see, that's a little sign for you. Alright? So, individuals who get sucked into this invariably suffer interiorly from tremendous doubt. Have you ever noticed, I find this especially, for example, in the realm of religion, you ever listen to those preachers who scream on and on and on? It's like, you gotta do it this way and this way alone, da da da. You know, the reason they're screaming and shouting is they're trying to convince themselves. Not you, not me. And that should be a sign to you. Somebody who seems to have no sense of the need to question reality or this issue invariably struggles with a lot of unconscious doubt. Secondly, is they have no self doubt or self criticism. This is just the opposite of the prophetic realm. Where the prophetic stance is that you do have a healthy doubt and a healthy criticism. If you don't believe me, read the story of Thomas. Thomas is a powerful story. We often call him Doubting Thomas. Thank God for him. He was a very honest man. He didn't care what the other disciples thought. He said, guys, I'm not going to believe unless I can touch this man. Unless I can actually put my finger in his hand and my hand in his side. That's what I need. Jesus said, okay, fine, come and do it. And he was the only one in the gospel story to make the personal statement, my Lord and my God. Mm-hmm. Peter said, you're the Messiah, which is a universal. Thomas said, I accept you. You're my Lord. You're my Messiah. So he went from a healthy self-doubt and criticism to now having clarity for himself. He didn't make it for everybody, but it was for himself. You understand? Mm-hmm. Make sense? Okay. Third one, controlling. Evil is all about controlling. What is controlling the individual? Controlling one's thoughts, one's feelings, one's behavior. All right? No sense of freedom. Whenever there is a lack of authentic interior freedom, you can pretty much bet that there's some evil going on. Okay? Some darkness that somehow or another is hovering inside it prevents this individual from really standing in their own unique identity as a human being. Because God is forever about setting you free. Setting you free from your own unreal expectation about yourself as a woman, as a man, as a parent, as an employer or employee, whatever. To help you, to give you the permission to be who you want to be. When my grandfather turned 80 years ago, I remember him saying to me, I was really taken by this statement. He goes, I'm 80 now. I don't have to live up to anybody's expectations. I didn't think he did, but he did change when he turned 80. He was a very stoic German man, full-blooded German. My gosh, all of a sudden he started acting like a little kid. It's like he gave himself permission. So God is forever giving us permission to be ourselves. Now, where do rules and guidelines come from? When you think about it, both within a family or a culture or a church or a business or an organization, rules and guidelines are given for what?
Control.
For control and for order. There's a place for that. But when they become the be-all and end-all, be careful. Now it becomes idolatry. Okay? That this is more important than the unique dignity of this human being. Okay? Alright. Fourth. When the shadow is not owned and is projected outwards, there's a real tendency to begin to believe that reality. That, oh, at least I'm not as bad as she is. Oh my God, have you heard what she did? You know? And at some level, it gives us permission about not having to look at our own stuff. Not having to look at our own stuff. Let me tell you a true and tragic story. This happened many years ago. There was a man who died, and at the graveside service, the wife was standing next to their son. He was 3 years of age. His name was Charlie. And everybody had left, and she was holding his hand, and she looked down at him and said, "Charlie, your father is gone. He's dead. He's not going to come back." I picture this from the viewpoint of a three-year-old. He's looking down into this hole where the casket's lying, listening to his mother. I don't have the patience or the wherewithal to put up with a boy who's going to be bad. I need you to be perfect, Charlie. Can you do that for mommy? These are her words, not mine. Of course, you can picture, I'll picture Charlie with big eyes. He nods his head yes. And according to all those who knew Charlie as he grew up, he really took those words on board. Okay, he was his perfect little boy. Never disobeyed his mother. Did everything she asked. Got good grades. Came home to take care of his mother. All that stuff. Okay? But interestingly enough, something happened in the latter part of his junior high. He began to develop a real attraction for weapons of war and violence. I have no idea why this woman allowed him to even collect these things, but he had them in his room. And when we went to high school, it just kind of expanded even more. He had all sorts of stuff, machetes and unexploded grenades and stuff. Wow, this woman's really out of touch with this part. Okay. So part of her thinking was, he's such a good boy, if this is all he's going to do, yeah, he can have it. He loved watching army movies and all these violent movies. That's where he'd spend his downtime. Well, according to the police report, one lazy Saturday afternoon, Charlie, now 16 years of age, was found walking in a daze with blood spattered all over his body down the middle of the street. And they took him back to his house, and there they found the mutilated body of his mother, cut up in pieces. He'd taken a machete and just chopped in pieces. That's a gruesome story, but that is what happens when you keep the shadow inside. It's called introjection. Projection is out, introjection is in. And so what happened, the break happened, that he had no recollection. Hey, have you ever taken, let's say, a beach ball and pushed it down in the water like a pool and then let it go? You ever notice what it does? Yeah, did it ever go straight up? No. It never goes straight up. It always goes at angles. It goes at a different angle than you push it down. That's what happens with this stuff. The more forcefully you repress or deny or push down the negative parts of who you are, this is the type of tragedy that can happen. And why we often hear, he was such a nice man.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know? Or she was such a nice lady, I don't know what got into her. That's what this stuff is. We feel very comfortable sitting in our high thrones, putting it out into somebody else and say, well, it's him, it's not me. Oh, everybody else's boy is bad, but my little Charlie, oh my gosh, she's an angel. And yet she's blind to the fact this kid is trying to literally express what's going on. Let me tell you another story. When I was getting my degree for counseling, I had a client, 13-year-old boy. And the presenting issue was his teacher had sent him to me because he was so fascinated with violence. Okay. So I got to know him, listened to the story, and one day I asked the question, which the whole counseling was around, and I said, call him my name, and I said, what do you do when you get angry? I beat people up. He had been nicknamed a wannabe gang member, and he had, he had been held back two different classes, so he's a big kid, 2 years older than the other boys in his class. I said, okay. I said, anything else you like to do when you get angry? He says, yeah. And he put his head down. Get this, When he said, I beat kids up, he put his head out with great bravado. When I said, is there anything else? He said, yes. He put his head down and he said quietly, I like to draw art. Mm-hmm. He said, oh, that's fascinating. I said, do you have any examples of it? He said, yes. I said, could you bring them to me in the next session? Absolutely. So he brought me these cartoons. They were exquisite, but they were all dark and black, but exquisite. I said, this is really good. Have you shown your teacher this? Again, he put his head down and he said, yes. What did she say? She said, don't ever do this again. I thought, poor lady, not very educated in the ways of the soul. And so we talked some more, and the next session I purchased an art kit for her. And I said, you know, you don't need to show this to your teacher, but I would like to invite you and encourage you to tell you that you are an artist. And God has given you a wonderful gift that sets you free when you're angry and frustrated. I won't even go into this family situation. So I invite you through this gift, whenever you get angry, just draw. I've never again heard a bad report about this kid. Mm-hmm. You see, here's the next lesson about this, is that impression without expression leads to depression. Mm-hmm. When life impresses something upon you, if you don't express it, it will move to depression. What often happens, though, with that impression, as this boy was taught, in some circles, it was okay to beat people up, but it was not okay to draw, because it wasn't masculine enough. You see? So, when an emotion impresses something on you, the invitation is to respond to it, to express. If you don't respond to it, you slowly begin to push it underground. You begin to deny, oh, that's not me, I can never do that. Okay? Or, mom wouldn't appreciate that. Okay? What would my wife think? You see? It has nothing to do with your reality of your attraction to this, or your experience of it, but it moves into denial. The next way to discern evil is to recognize that evil rarely comes at you straight on. Comes at angles. We call them disguises. Disguises. Evil comes in many disguises. Now I can tell you this as a priest who's been ordained almost 30 years, but I have met the most evil people in the church. I mean that. And some of the holiest people I've met. What better place to hide from God in authenticity than to go to church? Or to become ordained? You know, we're still in the throes of the effects of the scandal. You know what I mean? There's so many different places to hide. And if you get close enough to that which appears to be light and goodness and holiness, then you might think that, okay, I can kind of rub off on me. That's not the way it works. There are no shortcuts. You have to do the inner work. There's no time for late exams or procrastinating. It's a matter of doing the hard, difficult, plodding along labor. So, don't be fooled just because somebody's a daily communicant. Some of the worst counties of men are daily communicants. Let me tell you one. This lady, she was an older lady. I was a daily communicant. She loved to pray a rosary. And one morning, it was a Sunday morning, she was there in between masses praying a rosary in the first pew. And the director of the RCA came up and whispered to her. He wanted to serve the man. Could you move back a few pews? Because we're bringing in the RCA candidates and catechumens for a special ceremony. The woman completely ignored her. Okay, so she loved me. So she went up closer and she touched her gently on the shoulder and said a little bit louder, ma'am, could you move back? And she hardly got the words out. The woman had the rosary wrapped around her thing, you know, finger again. She turned around, she cold cocked the woman. And she went back to praying without saying a word. Hello? We call emotional disconnect there. Alright? A real disconnect. Now she in her own mind probably thought that she was defending Mary or Jesus or the church or whoever knows. She never would think, wow, what was I thinking? What did I do? So there's a real lack of not only self-criticism, but self-reflection to say, what was really going on there? You'll often find people like this saying, you made me do it. Mm. They didn't make you do it. It was your response. Another one is that evil trades in fear. It keeps you on your heels, keeps you off balance. So they become so muddy, you don't see things clearly. It's kind of like walking down a dark street where the street lights have gone out, and there's a bit of a wind. Up in the distance, it looks like there's somebody or something there. In reality, it's just a tree, or it's just a branch. Is that your perception of reality is skewed because the light isn't clear enough? Well, that's what fear does. Is it skews your perception of your reality. And you really aren't responsible for your feelings. Or it's not your fault. You know? He deserved it. And all those other things. Okay? Another way to look at how to discern evil is militant ignorance. Militant ignorance. This is the refusal to grow up. To take responsibility for your life. Alright? Just militantly saying, this is the way it is, I know it is, and don't confuse me with facts. Thank you very much. Have you ever met somebody like that?
Yeah.
There's a bit of a comfort level there. And I think at some level we all kind of go to that place sometimes. But I'm talking about people who live there. Who live there, day in and day out. Another way to discern evil is the need to protect your self-esteem. Now, this is an important one. Dr. Scott Peck wrote a whole book on it called People the Lie. It's not about protecting your person, it's your self-esteem. Meaning it's the way that you value or perceive yourself. Do you understand the difference? Let me tell you a story from Scott Peck's book. Happened to be a client of his that came to him. He was a sophomore in high school. And here was the presenting issue. His older brother, who was, when he turned 18, was given a rifle by his father and mother for his 18th birthday. Now, this family lived out in the country. And the father gave him the rifle as a gift. It was his way, basically, of saying, you know, welcome to the world of men, okay, which is understandable. But interestingly enough, there must have been a lot of stuff going on because the boy ended up committing suicide with the rifle.
Mm.
All right. Well, the next birthday, when this boy turned 16, his father gave him the same rifle.
Oh, God.
I'm glad to hear you responded that way. Why did you do that?
Oh.
What's that?
It repeated itself.
I didn't hear you.
It will repeat itself.
Why? Why would it repeat itself?
The family hasn't changed.
Get a rifle
first. Very good. Now, here's what happened. The boy was quite intelligent. He was making A's. He was doing very well at school. And this, even in the shadow of his older brother who committed suicide. But as soon as he was given that gift, he plummeted. He became depressed. His grades dropped. His parents couldn't understand what was going on. So the school counselor is the one intervening and said, you need to get this boy into counseling. And that's how it ended up with Dr. Peck. Okay? So, Dr. Peck took one or two sessions before he quickly saw what was going on, and he called the parents in. And he thought he was going to be dealing with a completely different response than what he got. Okay? He sat down, and he said, I understand that you gave your own son a rifle for the 18th birthday. Yes. Yes. It's a good rifle. And, okay. He said, did you happen to think that by giving the same rifle to your younger son, you might have been sending a message? He said, well, yeah, the message was, it's a good rifle, and I hope you're able to use it when you go out hunting. But why a rifle? Why not a tennis racket? Or did you even ask your son, maybe he doesn't like to hunt? No, I didn't think about that. And then as a defensive mechanism, okay? The man said, we're simple folks, sir. You're a doctor. We're not as smart as you are. We don't have much money. A rifle's a rifle. I had no idea what my son was thinking. And then Scott stopped him by saying, did you happen to think that by giving your second son a rifle, you told him in effect, go and do likewise? The man completely lied. His wife interrupted the two of them. They both started screaming at Scott. It was like they just couldn't see it, nor could they hear it. That's evil. That's about perception of self-esteem. Not, oh my God, I never thought of that. Now, it wasn't because they were uneducated. They didn't want to go there. They didn't want to question their perception of reality and to question what's more important here. The health and the nurturance of our son, or that we look good. That it's not our fault. Okay?
Well, maybe he couldn't handle the guilt of what happened in the first place.
Very possible. But still he's protecting his self-esteem, not protecting the life of his son. Another way to discern evil is to look at people who struggle with egocentricity. It's a fancy term that means self-centeredness. People for whom the world revolves around them. Their thoughts, their feelings, their needs, creating their own reality. Okay, it's a dangerous place to be. We often see lots of movies made about people like this, and these movies are easy to watch in the sense that it's so clearly we can see that as evil. But we all struggle with this from time to time. Okay? Is that my needs or my feelings or my perceptions are more important than you or than this whole group. And if the person's in power, it's even more dangerous. Because they can wield that power over the whole group. The last one is grandiosity, and it's similar, but grandiosity is having an inflated sense of self. Alright? And when that's your sense of self is inflated, it's not grounded in reality. And it will come out in some real negative behavior. Dr. Robert Moore tells a story of he was giving a conference to therapists and religious leaders. He's explaining that spiritual grandiosity is a very, very dangerous part whenever people are projecting their goodness, their goal onto you. Okay? And if you're not regularly practicing methods of deflating your ego, then you can end up doing some dangerous things in your life and in your close relationships. And he described the whole phenomenon. And he gave a list of some of the symptoms. He said, you know, you probably start with this, and this, and this, and this. As one man raised his hand, he stood up. Dr. Moore, he said, I enjoyed his presentation. I totally disagree with his last point. He said, oh, which part? He said, well, he said, I'm a Protestant minister, happily married, and I'm told that I preach really well. And he gave a whole list of the things that he'd been doing well, and people were affirming him and whatnot. Dr. Moore, you have to understand, he's a very direct man. He doesn't mess around. Doesn't mess around at all. He said, then you probably masturbate a lot. The man turned bright red and sat down. Then more compassionately he said to the man, sir, I don't mean to pick on you. He said, this is a fact. This is not a theory. He said, when you get inflated, when you become grandiose, you begin to believe your own PR. You see, and that's what's happened. You know, I don't deny the fact that you probably get to hear it, but obviously, look at how it's being moderated. Is that life is all about some type of balance. Okay, so those are some ways. There's many more, but that's a good beginning, starting point. Most evil, from the level that we're talking about, is done by unconscious people. People who are disconnected from their inner life. People who are not reflective. Take the time to truly be silent and pay attention. Jean-Paul Sartre once said that so much violence happens in our world because people do not take 30 minutes of silence a day. Right? So when you become disconnected from your instinctual feelings, you will create an alternate reality. C.G. Jung once said that because Christianity does not want to deal with this type of stuff we're talking about, his whole field of what is called analytical psychology came into creation. Is that originally this is the type of stuff that we're talking about. Do you know, for example, that up until about the 12th century, we used to have images, carvings, statues of animals in our Catholic churches? But if you look at them today, is that it doesn't focus so much on what we would call the fullness of being creatures, of being human beings. It's all very pretty. So remember gargoyles? When was the last time you saw a gargoyle in a church that was built the last 100 years? Not there. Originally, they were put there as symbols of protection. But now they've been renamed. It's like, oh, no, that's evil. But no, it was never intended to be evil. They were symbols of protection, reminding us that the dark world is very close to the world of goodness and blessedness and holiness. You don't believe me? Read the lives of the saints. Their autobiographies are better. It's right there. It's right there. You can't dispel it. You have to work with it one way or another. So, in this season of Lent, we hear a word that's put out often, metanoia. Greek word that means change your thinking. Change your thinking. Look at it from a new perspective. But if we go back to the Aramaic, I love this translation. The Aramaic word means come home. In other words, come home to who you are. Come home to your center. Come home to your Creator. That you might come to truly live in the truth. So the biblical text itself reveals both the problem and the solution. Whether you read the Hebrew Scriptures or the Christian Scriptures, that you'll find violence, and shortcomings, and evil, and darkness, because it's always a part of life. It's always a part of reality. But the icon for all of this, as Christian believers, is the cross. It's the paradox of the opposites. That this is where salvation takes place, at the coincidence of opposites. What does that mean? It means at some level we don't just look at the cross. We become the cross. We recognize that I, and become a mature human being like Jesus Christ, I have to hold within my body the tension of, doggone it, I'm a sinner, I'm incomplete. When do I get my act together? And hard for me to admit, but gosh, I share in Christ's divine nature. I'm holy. And we seem to fight back and forth with both of these, but to stand with patient endurance, knowing it's not me, it's God's work within me. And to hold both my evil, my darkness, my incompleteness, and my holiness, my blessedness, my goodness. And so that when people come up to you and say, oh, you're such a lovely lady, you're so good, you humbly say, thank you. And inside you say, well, Lord, thank you for what they see in me, but you know better than I, but there's more to me than that. You see? Don't do the opposite. It's like, oh, now if only you knew me, Betty. That's not true. You see, that's false humility. What they have done to you is they have put some gold into your lap. And you receive it very humbly. You say, well, thank you. Thank you for what you've said or seen. You accept it. All right? I gave a book to my brother Tony, a wonderful book by Robert Johnson, this whole area. And he called me up the other day and he goes, ah, I know what you're doing. He says, I want my gold back. He's been projecting his gold on me for years. And I said, well, I just thought you were probably going to take it. And he said, I am. He said, I asked my wife for my gold back from her and she wouldn't give it back. So maturity is about taking your gold back, but taking your darkness back and holding both. So holiness is not separating yourself from evil. It's about absorbing the evil into your personhood and letting it be transformed. Let me repeat that. It's not about separating yourself from evil, getting away from it. You can't go anywhere in the world to escape from evil. It's always there. It's part of the incompleteness of nature, of creation. Rather, it's an absorption and a transformation of evil. And that takes a lot of work. And depending upon how great the evil is, it will take a whole community. A whole community. It's very often that, you know, well-meaning spouses think, if I just love my husband or my wife enough, she will change. Okay? She will, or he will become the person I know him to be. No. Maybe you need some help, some reinforcements. That's the wisdom of the 12-step spirituality. They realize, you know, it takes more than just one drunk to help another drunk. You need a community of people who really know all the lies and ways you can fall down and pick yourself up again. So it takes one to know one. That we're not in this together, we're not in this alone, we're in this together. So holiness, Christian holiness, moves us away from the understanding, the experience of redemptive violence to redemptive suffering. Let me explain that. Holiness moves us away from the myth of redemptive violence to the divine plan, redemptive suffering. If you try and out-violent another person, you will become just like your enemy. I understand that during World War II, many of the German officers wore belt buckles and said, "Gott mit us." It said, "God with us." Okay? Hitler was quoted as saying, "If you come after me, you'll become just like me." Those of you who are veterans, you know that to be true. All the violence, not just that you went through, but in your own mind and heart afterwards. It's a lot of what we call post-traumatic stress syndrome. You know? It's like, my God, did I really do? Did I think I did? You see? It's all there. We have the capacity for great evil inside us and great holiness. And depending upon the context of our life, one or the other or both is called out. And why we need healing in our midst. Let me tell you what they did in Japan after World War II. They recognized that when the soldiers came back from World War II, they were not ready to live in a peaceful society. Because many of these soldiers began to commit crimes and began to heap a lot of their own violence onto their families. And so the elders came up with a wonderful idea that when the remaining soldiers started to come home, they gathered together as a village and they formed a circle around the individual soldier. They sat there one by one. Each one of the village members got up and thanked the soldier. They said things like this: "Thank you for your service to your country, to our nation, to us as a village. Thank you for your faithfulness, the following orders, for all that you did." And after everyone had said, then the elder stood up, summarized everything that they had said. And then he said, "You have been a loyal soldier. We thank you. Now it's time for you to let go of being a soldier. We don't need you to be a soldier anymore. We need you to be a peaceful citizen. Here's what we need from you." They had a list. It was amazing how these men transitioned so much better. You see? That simple but profound ritual allowed them to transition. To transition from this sense of redemptive violence to redemptive suffering. Come and suffer with us. In other words, come and be human with us. Don't fight us. Come and be human with us. So this is what Jesus called forgiveness. Letting go of the past. Moving on. And why the icon of the cross is a central symbol of Christianity. Because time and time again, we say, "But Lord, you know, he deserves it. You know, she's hurt me so bad, you know, at least I get to say some mean things about her." And all Jesus says, "Look at my cross. Look at my cross. Look at my cross." Because it's there we find, again and again, the only way out of violence. The only way of absorbing evil. The only way of making authentic transformation in our life is the way of Christ. So Jesus invites us to move away from tribalism to inclusivity and forgiveness. He invites us to move away from our own small worldview to catch his worldview. In that way, he helps us and offers us practical ways of learning how to truly love others. That does not mean that you necessarily will have good feelings toward them, but that you and I will make a commitment to truly walk these individuals, that I can learn, and you can learn from these individuals. Whenever we tend to absolutize particular human values, we create an equally powerful shadow value system. Very important for us to remember. Sometimes religious leaders and political leaders will absolutize certain values as a way of garnering either votes or support or leadership. So there's a clarity of purpose and where we're going. Alright?
Jim, what's that word?
Absolutize. To make an absolute. To make an absolute of any value. Okay? To make an absolute of any human value can be a dangerous thing. Because you set up a shadow or a parallel system. Let me give you an example. When I was touring Auschwitz concentration camp about 5 years ago, I was really moved. But not until I saw this picture. I was like, oh my God, it's so clear. It's a picture of the original administration building. And during World War II, painted on the roof of the administration building the five values that the Nazi government had and wanted to instill upon those in the concentration camp. Okay? This may surprise you what they were. You want to take a guess? Obedience. Loyalty. Work. So you get the picture. As soon as I saw it, it was like, it makes so much sense. So much sense. And once again, once it becomes so two-dimensional, it becomes brittle. And you know it's not real, but you can't put your finger on it. So what's the matter with this picture? Of course, hard work and obedience and loyalty are important, but when it's used to control human beings and not to set them free, then it steps in the realm of shadow, becomes dangerous. So Jesus relativizes some of the most important human values to any society. And in the scripture passage about these three values, most of us kind of skip over and say, well, he didn't really mean that. Yes, he did. Yes, he did. Healthy religion does not necessarily affirm cultural values. Repeat that. Healthy religion does not necessarily affirm cultural values. It takes the stance of a healthy criticism of cultural values. Say, well, if you value this, do you know what that means? So here are the three that Jesus relativizes. A personal or a group identity. You know, we live in an individualistic culture. The scriptures come to us from a communitarian culture. It's very different. And so we read the scriptures from our lens, our experience, which is understandable. But Jesus was not about saving the individual. That's not what Catholic Christianity believes. Jesus was about bringing salvation to all creation. And what that means is to move from the negatives in our life to the positives. Again and again and again. So he relativizes the personal or group perceptions. And says, be careful about saying that this is an absolute. This is what's most important. Secondly, our own security systems or careers or jobs. As if that's the be-all and end-all. And it's not. It's scary, especially this financial situation we're in. Very scary. But he's saying that should not be the place where you give your soul. Expect that you will be hurt. Walter Brueggemann, a famous scripture scholar, says that if you read the Bible from cover to cover, you'll notice a threefold pattern. Is that typically the person of faith is securely oriented in the first stage. Then they become painfully disoriented, not knowing where they're going, what they're going to do now because something's happened, something dreadful. And then they become surprisingly reoriented. Then he goes on to say, why do you think it's going to be any different for you? Of course, life will not turn out the way you expect. And you go through this again and again and again. On November 16th of last year, my mother passed away unexpectedly. She died 2 weeks after stroke. And 3 weeks later, my father passed away. I never would have guessed my parents would be gone in a matter of 3 weeks. And our whole family structure has changed. And you're looking at the patriarchy and I'm saying, I'm too young for this. But it's like, okay, God, we're all disoriented. Where are you going to lead us at? Selling the family home for 57 years, the only home I've known. All these changes. I know God's here somewhere. I believe that. We've experienced it. Why is God going to be any different? And so it's not about control, it's about trust and letting go, journey, faith, and pilgrimage, and all the things that we read about in the Bible. So the third value that Jesus relativizes, and this one's really going to sting us, is the nuclear family or family values. You see, you really find out what you believe when the gospel challenges these three. Sigmund Freud, no matter what you think about him, he said, you know, real faith begins when your parents die. Because that buffer to life is gone. Mm-hmm. Well, what do you believe in? What do you mean when you say the eternal or mystery? It's God. When there's no one or nothing to protect you. So it's about growing up in our humanity. About maturing as God's people. So how can we best respond to evil? Whether it's personal, communal, cosmic evil, demonic evil. Well, one way that is often presented in the scriptures and is lived in the lives of saints is this. Choose the good. Speak to the good. Seek the good wherever you go. And do not constantly focus on rejecting the bad. Because you become that which you focus on. Give me an example. When I was in my late teens and early 20s, I used to, every day, pray, God, please make me perfect. I know it's a simplistic and naive prayer, but please take away these sins and all that. God never heard my prayer. And every day I'd go to bed, I'd feel so depressed. I'd go, it's a failure. I thought, maybe I'm praying this wrong. And then I got this wonderful insight, and I began to pray this way, Lord, help me to accept my imperfections. Every day I'm getting a little bit better. A little bit better. But you become that which you focus on. If you're always focusing on your sinfulness or your incompleteness or your shortcomings, that's what people are going to see. That's what you're going to live from. But if you focus on the goodness that God is, that you are, the goodness in general, the goodness that are there, again, the Spirit, the Scriptures, then you become that goodness, pure and simple. So the best criticism of the bad, of evil, is the continuing practice of the good. That we keep at it, bit by bit. One by one, individually and collectively. Now you're right, you're not going to solve or repair everything that evil has done in your life, maybe not even in your life. But if you're faithful to the journey, day in and day out, faithful with God presents you at this time, watch and see what happens. Phenomenal. Alright? Great job.